First of all, I don't think I really did justice to Charlie's question last time about the rabbi setting communal standards, because really it's a balance, because sometimes rabbis tend to have their strongly held opinions, even if they're not even necessarily entitled to them, but they like to have them anyway, or they, a lot of times, there's one rabbi who doesn't know all of Shas, and he's taka done a lot of research and has investigated a certain topic extremely thoroughly, and maybe comes to the conclusion that a certain opinion that's found in the postgame or amongst contemporary authorities is not true. So then you have a little bit of an issue, because let's say the community is relying on this opinion, and you come to a different conclusion, so what are you supposed to do? So first of all, you have to realize that as long as they didn't ask you the shaila, that if they are following this opinion because they think it's a legitimate opinion, then you don't have to tell them otherwise. Maybe you could slowly, when the time is ripe, introduce your opinion, but it's not necessarily your place or even your responsibility, as long as there's a legitimate rabbi to rely on, to go ahead and tell everyone they have to be following a different opinion. Also, a lot of times when you think you've caught a certain rabbi in a particular halachic opinion, a lot of times you'll realize later on that it's not true, and really you can understand his opinion more as you mature more in your halachic thinking. So, if one is really entitled to opinion, knows all of Shas, and is a big rabbi, so you technically are entitled to your opinion, but still you might keep quiet about it for particular reasons. It's like, it's not exactly an analogous case, but apparently, you know, the Satmar Rav had very strongly held opinions, which were very much not in vogue necessarily among other segments of Jewry in America when he arrived here. One was that the mechitza in shul had to be high enough so that you could not see the women. That was insufficient to have even what Rav Moshe Feinstein considered adequate, which was that it had to be shoulder heights so as to avoid people intermingling. But the Satmar Rav held that in the shul, the mechitza had to be high enough so the men and women could not see each other at all. And one thing is that
the women can't see the men either. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's true. Okay, I guess the women could see the men because they would
I'm asking, is that so? The women
can't. No, the women could see the men. I think they're right. Yeah, the women could see the men. Sometimes they have one-way glass, one-way mirrors. Anyway, they have their. I mean, in many types of these constructions, the women really can't see the men. Maybe there are little holes, the lattice work to look through. If you ever went to a Hasidic shul, so normally the mechitza is constructed in a way, or the balcony is constructed in a way that the men certainly cannot see the women. And another thing he held was that Shabbos, you had to keep Shabbos for 72 minutes after sunset.
Was that starting Shabbos?
Starting it earlier.
Right. So he also held that you could start Shabbos later, but they agreed as a compromise. They had a gathering of a lot of rabbis, and they agreed that everyone was going to start Shabbos according to the earlier opinion, that you had to start Shabbos at sunset, and everyone was going to keep Shabbos according to the later opinion, on Motzei Shabbos, 72 minutes. So apparently, but again, the Satmar Rav tried to. Also, Chalav Yisrael, of course, that Savarov held that you have to have real Chalav Yisrael, Jews supervising the milk for all dairy products. So the Samarov, again, he sometimes used to send emissaries to other communities to try to convince them or to try to set this as the standard for everyone, which is not exactly the same case as we were discussing last time of a rabbi in the middle of nowhere setting policy for his congregation, but that's not really necessarily the way to go. Apparently, someone who was born in Frankfurt, who may be the grandson of one of the Dayanim in the times of Rav Hirsch, and he became a Satmar Chassid. The Satmar Rav sent him to Rav Breuer to try to convince Kahal Das Yeshurun to keep a Shabbos for 72 minutes after sunset.
Is he familiar with the expression throwing snowballs into hell? I mean,
exactly. So Rav Breuer answered. Rabbi heard him out, and Rabbi answered, you know, your father was a very big rabbi. He was one of the Dayanim in the times of my grandfather. And according to what you're saying right now, your grandfather was Michal Shabbos. So that was the end of that conversation, and he didn't want to listen to him anymore. Anyway, but the Zmanim issue is a different whole discussion. I think that the 72-minute thing is not correct for many different reasons. But there was people, sometimes take, for example, Rav Moshe Feinstein held that Shabbos ends approximately 50 minutes after sunset. If you read his tshuva, when I was younger and I was researching the issue of Zmanim, I would read Rav Moshe's tshuva. I read Rav Moshe's tshuva about this Zmanim, and I said, this logic makes no sense. I don't understand. How could this be? You know, you think you read the tshuva, and you don't understand. This contradicts all the poskim. It doesn't make sense astronomically, etc., etc. So as I got older, I realized that he was correct. Rav Moshe was 100% correct. Maybe you could argue on the reasoning with some of the logical leaps. Okay, but the basic conclusion that he had is basically more or less correct. So sometimes when you get older, you think you have a different perspective on these types of things. Also, sometimes you think you're reading the Rambam. Think, oh, I'm going to read the Rambam very honestly, and I'm going to figure out what the Rambam is really talking about. So you have a careful reading of the Rambam. You say, oh, this contradicts Rav Moshe, this contradicts a different posek, whatever. You think, oh, it must be wrong, because he failed to make this reading of the Rambam. And it could be you're right, it could be the Rambam held that, but yeah, there's a lot more that goes into the halachic process besides a simple reading of a certain Rishon. So that's something to keep in mind. If a rabbi is not asked the shaila, he doesn't have to answer it, basically. Unless it's a huge communal thing, he thinks it's a huge chil Hashem, he can't stomach such a thing in his community, and he has to put his foot down about a certain thing. But in the ritual, unless it's something that's going to affect, you know, if people are in the community are keeping wildly different standards of kashrus, and he has to do something about it, nobody in the community is going to be able to eat in each other's houses or something of that nature. Okay, but in terms of nowadays, the way it works is that everybody gets to choose their rabbi, and if you don't ask the shaila, you don't have to answer it. This wasn't the case. Certain other rabbis don't have this MO. That there was someone, as you know, who wanted to who bake his own matzah at home. So one of the
yeah. Yeah, so I heard about that.
So there was a rabbi who met him walking around somewhere on the street and said, "Oh, you cannot bake your own matzahs at home. We will not have matzah baking. We will not have matzah baking Washer nights. You know, it's an Isser Karis, and you can't do that." And you know, the fellow said, "With all due respect, I didn't ask you the shaila. You can't answer the shaila. I didn't ask you." Okay, so we're really on mitzvah Pei Aleph, the 81st mitzvah. And then that is, Shelo lehatos mishpat chote mipnei risho. That not to distort the judgment of a sinner because of his wickedness. Shelo lehatos hadin al echa mibale hadin, kishiyeda shurosha bal averos. So not to distort, to force the judgment to go in a certain direction because you know that one of the litigants violates commandments. You shall not distort the judgment of one of your poor people in his fights or struggles. This doesn't mean a literal poor person who doesn't have enough money. That we discussed the opposite case in Mitzvah Ayin Tes two mitzvahs ago, where we talked about how you should not have specific mercy on a poor person in judgment. You should make the judgment exactly according to the way the halacha prescribes. She'ein b'mashma she'e evyon b'mamo, not that he is poor in money. She'ein tzarech lomar shelo yatu alav hadin ligzol mamono b'onyo. That, why would the Torah even need to tell us that we shouldn't, understandable that the Torah told us that we shouldn't make the judgment in his favor. Why should the Torah tell us that we shouldn't make the judgment against him? Of course, to take his money unjustly is a double sin, because he's A, he's poor, and B, he's not really liable to pay that money. Elan istavinu sh'afal pishu rasha lo yomer adayin hol v'rashu ata olav esadin. The dayin shouldn't say, oh, he's a wicked person, so I'm going to try to make sure the judgment goes against him because he deserves it. Ki amishba b'rashoyim lelokimu, that God is in charge of making sure that wicked people receive their due and not you. Velolo. V'cheinu v'mechilta rasha v'chosh om d'ufonecha badin shem atomar. The mechilta tells us, and the halachic midrashim tells us, that also you shouldn't say, if you have two people in front of you, one is wearing, you know, a nicely starched white shirt and tie and black pants, and the other person is wearing a tank top and shorts and sandals, so you shouldn't say, oh, you know, one person seems more religious than the other, so I'm going to probably, the one who looks more religious is telling the truth and the other one is lying, so therefore I'm going to decide the court case based on that. That's not true. You have to
back at that.
You're right. You have to look beyond completely all the external trappings and see purely according to the substance of the case. Actually, it's funny I use that example because there actually is a halacha. It may not be practiced so much anymore, but there is a real halacha that the two litigants are not supposed to have different levels of clothing. That really, if there's a very rich person who's wearing Armani suits to the trial and there's another person who is wearing, old holy shirts and khaki pants, then you actually force the guy who's wearing Armani, you say either to buy him a suit that's of a similar quality to the suit that he's wearing. If he says, "Well, I don't want to do that," say, "Okay, so you dress the way he's dressing." Because really, you're not supposed to have these external factors to even be tempted to make the judgment go in accordance with a way that it shouldn't really be going according to the halacha. Shorish hashvaya sadin b'chol adam davar muskahu. That the reasoning behind making everyone equal while they're litigating is something that's quite understandable and reasonable. B'noeges b'chol makom b'chol zman, in all places and all times, v'zicharim avalo b'nekevos she'in andanos. All places and all times, males, because there's the ones who are doing judgment. Again, also, if you have a few, accept a woman to be your judge, then that's all, she would also be subject to these laws. So, over osa, v'ita hadina harasha, avar al mitzvah smelech. That if you did this, then you violated the commandment of the king, but there's no actual punishment. First of all, it's nitan li shavon. It's also lav shein b'maisa. It could be given back, and there's no actual deed associated with violation of this mitzvah. So, therefore, there's no earthly penalty for this. You'll just be, God will reckon with you at the end of days. Mitzvah pei beis, the 82nd mitzvah, shelo lachto chadin b'omed hadas. That similarly, you should not make the judgment go in accordance with estimation, or just because you think that something seems to be true. It has to be based on hard facts and hard edus, testimony. Shelo yargu bezdin hanidon kiim be'idim me'idim al osu inyan shu neragalav shera'u sha'asa osu be'ineha mamish. That the bezdin should not kill someone with administer the capital punishment until they receive witnesses that testify that they actually saw him or her perform this sin. Lo shi'idu alav mitzad osos chazakos, not that because of estimations, because there were clear signs that he performed the avera, then if the edim say that, they feel that there are clear indications that he did, so that doesn't count. It has to be actual physical sight.
So circumstantial evidence is not admissible then.
Right, yeah.
Or expert testimony for that matter.
Right, that's true, yeah. Mm. Unless, everything, all these types of things are subject to the Bezdin thinking what is necessary for the place and time. So let's say there's a place and time where there's been a run of murders and it's a real problem in the town, then the Bezdin could decide that they're going to administer the capital punishment even though they don't have as hard testimony as halacha really requires because the time requires this emergency response. So that is also a possibility. You shall not kill someone who is clean and righteous. Be very, very careful not to kill someone that there's any possibility that he didn't do what these edim are testifying that he did. Explicitly in the Mechilta, Sham Rasham, Rauhu Rodef Achar Chaveru Lahargo, Vehisrabo. That if you see someone running after his friend to kill him, then, and they say to him, "Don't kill him, he's a Jew. Ben Brisu, he's the son of the covenant. Imarakto so teharig." That if you kill him, then you're gonna be killed with capital punishment. Then, they ran into a house or an enclosed area, or the Aden happened to get distracted by something else, and their eyesight stopped following these people. Then, miyad harug mefarper. The Hasaif Menativ Dami Adorig. Then you find, next thing you know, they turn their eyes back or they follow these people into the enclosed area. And they find that the person is taking his last breaths and the person who was running after him to kill him is holding a sword with blood on the end of it. So maybe he would be liable because all reasonable evidence points to the fact that, in fact, he did kill this person. And he not only that, but he had a hasra before, he had a warning before. So Tamulomar Venoki Vitzadik Al Tarug, you should not kill someone clean and righteous. Hare Shemipnesha Limwayneam Beishaka Niftarza. So that because the Edim failed to actually witness the event, then the then he's exempt from the capital punishment. V'choshar adavar v'royli oskein, this is proper. She'ilu hitira ator el hakim gvuli ha'onesh b'efsharus ha'karov, yeitze min ha'inyan lifamim l'hakim gvuli ha'onesh b'efsharus racho, kashanamis b'nei adam lifamim ma'amash shelo asu. That if the Torah had given us permission to administer the capital punishment when something was very likely, then sometimes there we would probably kill people that didn't do the actual action. So in order to make absolutely sure that that doesn't happen, then the Torah requires actual visual testimony. When something's possible, just possible and not known for sure, then there's a lot of room for error. The Dazev, the Havineu, Kidavar Baruhur, know this because it's a clear thing. God closed this gate, so to speak. All the commandments of God are straight, are clear. So this is only applicable to capital cases, but in many other cases of halacha, we know seeming evidence is, circumstantial evidence, or a strong possibility is acceptable as edus. There is a machlokis about weddings that the Chasam Sofer and others have a right that if two people are in the audience of a wedding and they see the husband say Arayat Mekudeshesli and everybody's shouting, everybody from the front is shouting Mazel Tov, and the rabbi who's Masadar Kiddushin is a real knowledgeable rabbi who's going to make the ceremony done properly, and then that is sufficient evidence to consider the woman absolutely married, and you would not be able to matter her, you would not be able to let her go without a get and under any circumstances. However, this does contradict the Ramah. The Ramah in Shulchan Aruch says that if you the witnesses have to actually see the husband place the ring on the wife's finger. Mm-hmm. So that's why we have two Edom specifically come up, and they're gonna look very carefully and make sure, and they're gonna watch very carefully to make sure that's the person these are the two people getting married. Rabbi Reb Nosson Adler is saying that really all our kiddushin nowadays is based on just estimation rather than absolute sight, because the wife wears a veil. And since you can't see who the bride is really, so you assume it's the person who's supposed to be the bride. But nowadays, we modern Orthodox people, we don't use veils that are so thick anymore, so now you know exactly who the bride is. But in certain more right-wing circles, they still have the practice that they have that the bride is veiled with a very thick veil. So to avoid this problem, actually, and many times even at very right-wing weddings, the kala will lift up her veil immediately before the kiddushin, so that the witnesses can see that this is the person who's supposed to be the veil, and they can offer the proper testimony. So apparently there was once a wedding, and Reb David Soloveitchik, the Brisker Rav's son, was Mesader kiddushin, and one of the Edim, I think, was Rabbi Zilber, who's known to be extremely religious. He's a Rav in Bnei Brak. He wrote a book, a sefer, called Oz Nidburu, a book of responsa. So he was supposed to be one of the witnesses. So Reb David Soloveitchik was machmir for this, that the witnesses had to actually see the bride. So they were going to lift up her veil. So he said to the other witness, okay, now take a careful look at who the kala is. And then he said to Rabbi Zilber, okay, aide, you have to take, now when we lift up the kala's veil, you have to take a very careful look at who the kala is. Rabbi Zilber said, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not going to look at a woman intently, especially to the extent that I have to look at her to figure out exactly who she is and remember her face. I'm not going to do that. So the Soloveitchik said, "Well, in that case, goodbye. You can't be an aide. You're not going to be an aide if you're too religious. So you can't be an aide on my watch while I'm Mesader Kiddushin." Also, and so we know then for many other things strong circumstantial evidence is acceptable. Certainly, we know the famous thing we discussed last time about the milk, that even if the Jew didn't actually see the milking, then according to the Gemara says, under certain circumstances, if the Jew is right beside it, it could be still considered Chalav Yisrael. Or Moshe Feinstein's more expansive definition, that even if the government is supervising the milk, it could still be considered Chalav Yisrael. There's also another area of halacha where even for capital cases, that very strong evidence of this nature would be acceptable, which is the halacha of arayos, that if somebody is engaging in a forbidden sexual act, that would render him or her liable for the death penalty. So if all the witnesses have to see is that this man and woman are appearing to be in a manner of engaging in a sexual act. They don't actually have to see the actual penetration per se, but just seeing the two people in an act that strongly, strongly suggests that's what they're doing is sufficient for them to receive the death penalty. That's called in halacha. It's called seeing michol b'shvil feres. The euphemism is the mascara brush inside the mascara tube. So you don't have to see them as if there's a mascara brush inside a mascara tube. You just have to see something that strongly suggests. The od nichlal b'chlal avze included in this negative commandment is mi sheidu alav shneidim shera'ahu she'avar avera achas. So let's say you have two witnesses, and one says he violated Shabbos and a Malacha Deraisa, and the other says he worshipped Avodah Zarah. Both are capital offenses, but they're different sins. Shezeino nidon beidusam. This person cannot be judged based on their testimony. Shenemar v'naki v'tzadik al taru. Again, the same pasuk. Because even though, according to the testimony of both, he should be liable for the death penalty, so you could say that the edus of these two edim should join together. That you mimanav shach. Either way, they both are testifying that he's liable for the death penalty, and that's not true. You have to have two witnesses who saw the same act in order to consider him liable for the death penalty. V'chein amar zichronam livracha. Even if they both say that he worshipped the Avodah Zarah, the same sin, but one said he worshipped the sun and one said he worshipped the moon, so maybe they'll be together. Oh, they're both saying he worshipped the Avodah Zarah. You have to have two people who witnessed the exact same act in order to consider him liable for the death penalty. Shorish mitzvah niglahu kemosha marnu. The reasoning is obvious, that in order to avoid people being put to death unnecessarily. Even if they two witnesses are not joined together as a group, a kas, in order to put him to death, unless they actually both were together when they saw the act. Even if they saw the same act, if they saw it from two vantage points, it's not okay. They have to be able to see each other, the two witnesses have to be able to see each other while they're watching this person perform the act. Let's say one saw him from a building on one side of the street and one saw him from a building on the opposite corner peering out of the window, then that would not be acceptable because they could not see each other at the time. So let's say that there's a third person who administered the appropriate warning that he said, if you do this, you're going to be put to death. And the person said, yeah, he does it anyway. So if the two witnesses can both see the person who warned him, usually it would be one of the witnesses who would do the warning. But if there's a third person who does a warning and the two witnesses both saw the warner, then they don't need to see each other because the warner joins the two edim as one unit. The Eser Prata, the rest of the details, B'Sanhedrin, of course, B'Noikis, Beretz Yisrael, in the land of Israel, B'Zecharim, Kemo Shamarnu, Lefi Shebohem HaMishpat, Kemo Shamarnu, Kamet Bamim, it's only for men. Avalo benikevos v'ish ein andanos, not with females because they don't judge. Of course, not capital cases; they can't judge at all. Ve'over alev adon al piedush ein mechuvenes kemo shemarnu. If you did in fact judge according to testimony which was not appropriately accurate and together, over al mitzvah smelch, you violated the mitzvah of the king. She'ancha gadol meod shigarim laharug nefasha shelo kedin. That his sin is very great. Again, he causes people to die unnecessarily, but again, there's no earthly punishment involved. The Ramban, zichrona lebracha, the Ramban has a different opinion about exactly how to calculate the mitzvahs over here. Chashav zeha mikra bishnei lavin ul inyan echad. That this pasuk, laki v'tzadik al tarug, was for two negative commandments, for one idea. V'usha niftar b'dini nefashos, v'tzadim sh'nechai b'dini mamonos. What it's telling you is that we should be more stringent regarding standards with capital cases than with monetary cases. V'samach amash amru b'gemara Sanhedrin, says in the Talmud in Sanhedrin, Tan Rabbanu minayin liyotze b'beizdin chayev v'amar echad yesh l'lameid alav z'chus shemachzirin oso, that there's a brisa that tells us that if somebody's leaving the Bezdin and he was just convicted, and somebody says, wait a minute, I have evidence to declare him to exonerate him, that you take him back and write it back into the Beis Din. Shnemar v'naki v'tzarek al tarog, shekilomar v'zenokihu, d'shema yesh lamed shunaki, that this person is, can be considered clean because maybe you know that he's clean. U'minayin liyotz mi Beis Din zakai. But what if you are, he's leaving the Beis Din exonerated and somebody says, v'yomer echad yesh lamed alav chova, one person says, wait a minute, I have evidence to convict him. She'ein machzirin oso, you don't take him back. Tamalomar v'tzadik al taru, you should not kill a righteous person. V'zetzadiku shekvar yotza tzadik. This person is a righteous person because he already became a tzadik by the declaration of the Beis Din that he is not liable for this punishment. Hine yedaktiku hamikra lishnei lavin. So he considers it to be this one pasuk to teach us two negative commandments rather than one. Well, it doesn't really matter because everybody agrees the same basic idea that that really we're trying to make it to as hard as possible to exonerate people. Maybe he repented. Because unless he's really, really liable for the death penalty, we assume that people did tshuva and God wants people to survive. Everybody knows the pasuk, lo achbo to mos ameis. We don't want, God doesn't want people to die, but rather to repent and become contributing members of society. Okay. Shelo likach shochad, shelo yikach hadayin shochad. Mibale hadin, that the judge should not take bribes from the litigants, afil ladun din emes, even if he knows the way that the trial is going to go and the people he's going to pass in the correct way anyway, still he cannot take a bribe from the party that's correct in order to pass in that they're correct. Shenemar v'shochad lo sikach, don't take shochad v'nichba alav b'torah b'zeh ha'inyan b'makom acher. In Dvarim we know it says aror lo keach shochad, that not only that, not only is it forbidden, but somebody who takes bribes is considered to be cursed. V'chenemar b'sifri v'lo sikach shochad afilu zako zakar l'chayev chayev. That in the Sifri, the Alechem Medrash, it tells us also that even to exonerate somebody who deserves exoneration and to declare guilty somebody who deserves to be declared guilty, then you may not take bribes in any way, shape, or form, period. Mishor she'a mitzvah. The reasoning is as follows. Shenesar aleinu likach ha-shochad afilu ladun esadin la-mito. Even to offer a correct judgment. Kedei lohasir mi-beininu ha-hergel hara. That the whole institution of bribery should not exist. Because if you start taking bribes for one thing, so you're gonna, it's very easy to start taking bribes for another thing, and maybe somebody will offer you a bribe and say, I would really like to win this court case. Can you arrange that for me? And you think to yourself, I probably would have exonerated him anyway. I would have declared him the winner of the court case. Probably he's just giving me a bribe because it's true anyway. So I'm gonna just, it's okay for me to take the bribe. The answer is no. When it comes to money, people's judgment is somewhat clouded. So therefore, you cannot take any bribes in any way, shape, or form. Right. It might lead to use of bribes to declare, to judge the court case falsely. I don't need to prove this to you because you basically get the idea. Midine ha-mitzvah, the halachos of the mitzvah are as follows, Masha amru zichronim livracha, shad nosin v'hamakabel overin balav, that both the person who pays a bribe and the person who accepts a bribe violates a negative commandment, but not the same negative commandment. Hanosin mishum v'lifnei evir lo sitein michshol, that the person who gives a bribe violates the precept of do not place a stumbling block before the blind. We know that you're not allowed to facilitate people violating mitzvos, not even just performing them yourself. And we know that it certainly doesn't just mean they're not allowed to place a literal stumbling block in front of a literal blind person. It means anyone, you're not allowed to do such an action for anyone to put a stumbling block in front of them. And so this is certainly a very easily violated thing. That if you offer someone money, if you offer a judge money, like I said, money clouds judgment. So if you offer the judge money, then the judge is going to be tempted to take it. And v'im kiblo shehu b'chlal oror. So if you accepted the bribe, then you violated the commandment, and you, again, you're cursed. The Torah says aror, that someone who takes a bribe is cursed. So it's interesting, the pasuk by the curse says to, that to do a capital case to put someone to death who is not really liable for the death penalty. But still, we the chinuch is assuming that the auror still applies to any type of case. Even a goy, by the way, is not allowed to take bribes. Of course, because one of the sheva mitzvahs b'nei Noach, the sheva mitzvahs that all people in the world have to do is what is called dinim, which is having righteous courts. So bribes are obviously one of the hallmarks of a non-righteous court. Anyway, the chayiv lahachziro. Not only that, the judge has to return the bribe if he took it. And not only that, there's another halacha that the judge is not allowed to make it seem that he's a bigger dayan than he really is, so that the attendants in the court, such as the scribes, court reporters, and people used to do this by hand, they used to have court reporters that will write down all the proceedings of the court, and let's say he wants to have a nicer establishment, he wants the sofer and his scribes to get a higher salary. So one day he's going to, instead of coming to the court in a regular suit, he's going to come in a long black coat, a longer rekel, and he's going to start wearing an up hat, and he's going to make himself look like he's a very big dayan. He looked like he knows more than he does, so he gets more kavod. And his attendants get extra honor and extra money, then that is also considered to be a form of violation of lo sikach shochad. V'shafil shochad dvarim aser likach. You're not even allowed to take verbal shochad. In other words, to take extra honor or extra greetings. Let's say the party, one of the parties is not, you don't really see each other that often, and you're not used to greeting each other, and then one day he happens to see you, and he says, "Oh, Judge, how are you doing? It's so nice to see you." That is also forbidden. So the judge has to have in mind, at the outset of the trial, I'm not paying attention to any of these things. Let's say that one of them tries to honor me more, I'm just not going to pay attention to it. I'm going to consider it as if they're equal. There's a story in the Gemara that one of the litigants, even before the trial started, helped one of the dayanim get out of a boat, extended his hand, helped the dayan get out of a boat, and then the case came in front of his judge, and the judge said, "I'm not allowed to be a dayan for you because I'm already in your, I'm already predisposed towards you because you did a favor for me." That's a question. Actually, that's the actual halacha, or that's only midas chasidus. If it's before the trial and you had no idea what was going to happen, and it's a whole discussion about before the trial exactly what the extent of this is, but in any case, you see how far we go to try to avoid any semblance of the dayan favoring one party over the other. Klalo shel davar, the bottom line is, aser ladayan lekabel hanoa mibali hadin, the judge may not receive any type of benefits from the litigants. Klal bishvil dinov, aval, what? There's one exception, avalim adayan hu bal melocha. If the dayan also has a day job, he's a doctor or a lawyer, or he is a wood chopper, then he tiru lo chachomim lishol mibali adin schar batoloso, that he could receive what's called schar batola, that's a principle in halacha, many times in halacha, where even if you're not allowed to pay someone outright, you're allowed to pay someone for the loss of time. That really, why should I take out my time to judge for you right now? I could be working as a doctor and making $500 an hour. Why should I judge for you? So the litigants will say, okay, so we'll pay you as if you're doing your doctor activities. We'll each pay you $250 per hour for the baal, for the din Torah, and that is considered acceptable for edim. Also, there are many times in halacha for teaching Torah. We're really not supposed to, someone's really not supposed to take money to teach Torah. That's one of the reasoning for allowing it nowadays is because, well, you could be doing a different malacha. Why should you? We need now full-time teachers and rabbis. So one of the reasons is called schar batala, that we're paying you to do this instead of doing something else. Okay, it's a little, so they're gonna pay him equally. Shehu schar batala bilvad velo yoser. It has to be obvious that this is no more than schar batala paying him for instead of doing another job. If no, this is assuming that he has another job, and you're saying take time off from your job to don to judge for us. We assume nowadays that people are not going to be dayanim, people are not going to be rabbis unless that's their only job. So we're more lenient about this. That we assume that basically it is. You're paying him to say because we want a rabbi and we want a dayan, so we're paying you to do this instead of taking another job. But here it says it has to be nikar that schar batala, which is really only if you have another job. So anyway, yeah, it's a big suya. V'itol mishneim b'shave, each of the litigants has to pay exactly the same, not a cent more. Otherwise, you might favor one over the other. V'itol mishneim b'shave, so v'yeser pratea, the rest of the details are in Sanhedrin. V'noeges b'chol makom v'chol zman v'zcharim shehem donim. Again, this is for males, or of course for females also, should they be accepted as a judge. What? Oh, you mean the judge has no knowledge? Let's say they're working with the Bezdin administrator says, okay, your dintara is going to cost $500. You tell me how you want to work it out. And one person offers to pay more than the other, and the judge has no knowledge of that? We're talking about making a deal in advance. We're talking about making a deal in advance. The judge says, okay, I'll judge for you for $500.
So then if
the judge has no idea who's paying what, then yeah. If he's paying they're both paying the fees to the Bezdin, and the Dayanim has no idea. But why would you agree to that? Why would one litigant agree to pay more? That's different. That's part of the judgment. That would be part of the judgment that the losing party, the Dayan doesn't get paid more per se because of that per se. Dayan gets paid a set fee. Either they say, okay, we're each going to pay this, or maybe part of the judgment will be, no, you have to cover all of his legal fees. But that doesn't influence you to change the outcome of the din. Right, okay. It's talking about making a deal before. Yeah, okay. That's not the case, of course. Sometimes there's a get where, you know, one party is not really, usually the two it's supposed to be. I mean, okay, there was a takana that the wife is actually supposed to pay for the get. But normally the normal course of action nowadays is that the parties split the cost of the get. So sometimes, of course, there'll be one party that's interested in having a get and another party that's not interested in having a get. Okay, but in any case, sometimes they're not being malicious, they're just being lazy. Like there was one case where there was a couple that was completely not religious, and they got divorced. They had no get. Many years later, a few years later, the husband wants to get remarried, and his new Masadar Kiddushin is a little bit more traditional. And he said, where's your get? He said, I never got a get. Oh, you have to get one. So he calls up his ex-wife. They haven't spoken for however many years. He said, you know, I want to get remarried. So she's like, she's not malicious. They're divorced. He said, okay, I'll participate in the get, but like, I'm not paying for it. You know, go ahead. If you want to pay for it, you can have it. I'll come and participate, but you know, sometimes that happens.
Get blessings.
Yeah. I mean, both parties should be equally interested
in
having
it. It's the interest of society to get this get moving.
Right. Again, I don't know. Maybe it could be that their original marriage was not kosher. So, b'dyeved,
yeah,
we'd be mata her without a get. But we every single suffix in a get, we try to be choshish for. So even if in emergency situations, we know that we normally rely on the fact that non-Orthodox weddings, where we assume no, and we don't think there were any people who are or from Orthodox people who were kosher to be eidim present at the wedding. So b'dyeved, we assume that. That if a woman cannot obtain a get, that she can get remarried without a get. But of course, there was the famous sheet of Rav Henkin. Rav Henkin felt that, who was the major posik in America before Moshe Feinstein arrived on the scene, he felt that when a couple lives together publicly, that constitutes a de facto marriage. And that so you cannot be matar a woman without a get. They're completely 100% halakhically married. And if the woman leaves the husband and gets remarried, then her children will be mamzerim. So that's not accepted by the halakhic establishment. We rely on remotion in emergency situations. But lechatchila, we certainly, even for completely not from weddings, completely secular, only a civil marriage, if there's any suffix whatsoever that these people were married, even if the people never got married. There was a case also we had at the Beis Din where there was a quasi from couple, I guess, they were somewhat traditional, where they were maybe planning to get married, I don't know, but they were living together. So she wanted to get, they split up, and she wanted to get remarried, I think, in England, and the Bezdin in London said that they would like her to have a get, because they were living together in a somewhat public manner. So there is, again, b'dyeved, if push came to shove and she could not attain a get, we would matter her without a get. But ideally, the Beis Din in London that was arranging the new marriage would wanted her to have a get, even though she did not undergo any marriage ceremony at all whatsoever. No, we try to be choshish for him whenever possible. Yeah. Even if there's also a case where, even if there was a case where the person is probably not Jewish, like the person or the mother, or the one of the party's mothers had a Reform conversion, and we certainly would not accept the person as Jewish, but since you could construct some halachic opinion where maybe b'dieved the person would be considered Jewish, again, if push came to shove, we would absolutely paskin that this person is not Jewish and they don't require a get, but we try even to get a get from those types of people. I was writing a get for such a case once, where I think it was the husband was, he or his mother had a Reform conversion. So I made some small mistake when I was writing the get. So normally we would have liked to correct it, or we would have written a new get. So the Mesader of the get called one of the more experienced Sofrim, a very big expert in Gittin, and he called him up and said, okay, we're writing a get for a goy, so can we let this mistake go? So I was like, yeah. Because even if the person had been Jewish, so b'dieved, there are many opinions that the get would have been kosher anyway, but ideally we probably would have tried to, l'chatchila, we would have tried to write a new get, but since the person was probably not Jewish anyway, then, but we still wanted to have a get on hand there, yeah.
This opinion of Moshe,
yeah.
You know, is he supported by, you know, the other, I mean, this is sort of, it seems kind of strange. Here, if essentially you have, for example, say, Reform or conservative wedding,
mm-hmm.
and here are two Jews who get together under a chuppah, and they have the whole thing there, and, you know, the idea that somehow or other they did not have intent for Kiddushin?
Uh-huh. It's not they didn't have intent for Kiddushin, it's that there were no valid Edom, so there are no valid Edom, so then there's no Kiddushin.
You know, there might have been, who knows, there might have been a couple of Orthodox cousins in the
group. Right,
so that's maybe they didn't have a clear view of the, yeah. you know, the ring
no,
of the
so that's
finger.
That's really, but so
I went
didn't,
to a wedding.
Yeah. It's also advisable, by the way, just for anybody here, if you're ever invited to a non-Orthodox wedding, so it is probably worthwhile to exit the room during the chuppah so that you don't create shilas if they get if they ever get divorced.
Well, I could tell you a couple of stories.
Yeah. Yeah. So actually, in fact, the most significant figure for Kiruv in the 20th century was Moshe Feinstein.
Yeah.
Because without him...
Well, that's accepted.
You know, most Jews would be mamzerim. There is no possibility of that here.
That's accepted by the mm-hmm. by the halachic establishment. Now, the mm-hmm. rabbanut in Israel. I mean, everybody accepts that. It's not. It's not really a matter. Lechatchila, again, we try to be choshish for Avenkin. But yes, of course, yeah. If he has any obvious financial, or he even knows he's friends with one of them, or any connection to one of the mm-hmm. litigants, yeah, definitely the judge has to recuse himself. Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, then I think I have to run out. So I think we're gonna stop here. Next week we'll resume at the normal time of 9 o'clock, unless people prefer this. Any no? Oh, v'noheges. Oh, I didn't finish that. Okay, v'noheges b'chol makom v'chol zman, all places and all times. Zecharim shem tanor. V'alver aleh v'kibel shochad over al mitzvas melech v'noloke l'fi shenitan lishavon. You don't receive lashes if you took a bribe, because you could give back the bribe and sort of undo some of the damage that the bribe caused, or if you caused an incorrect judgment based on this, you could ensure that the money it go to the correct party in the end.